the mass graves and torture chambers imposed by Saddam Hussein and his accomplices. On May 27th of this year in New York City, there was a great celebration of Elie Wiesel and his contributions to world peace. Kofi Annan, Secretary General of the United Nations, introduced him as his appointed peace messenger for the United Nations. Ambassador Richard Holbrooke said, "Elie Wiesel is a moral force transcending governments and nations," and he went on to explain how. And Elie, on that occasion, revealed a hidden side of himself. He had studied violin when he was a youngster and paid his teacher with plum brandy. When the lesson began, the teacher began to drink the brandy, and when the brandy was gone, the lesson was over. Elie remarked that if he had had more plum brandy to give to his teacher, he might have developed into a serious violinist. We can all be grateful that the supply of brandy was limited. In the past, Elie has chided me for anticipating in my introduction the substance of his lectures. I won't deny the charge, but I do take the Fifth Amendment. This year, however, I have a special problem. The title of his lecture is, "In the Bible, Amos and Habakkuk. Minor prophets?" Question mark. When a title is framed as a question, how can anyone familiar with the Talmudic tradition, illuminated so effectively by Elie Wiesel, fail to anticipate what he will say? Now, on the one hand, they are major prophets, but on the other hand, they are minor prophets. And moreover, on the one hand, Amos is clearly a major prophet, but on the other hand, Habakkuk is a minor one. So, in conclusion, Amos and Habakkuk are both major and minor prophets. What could be more obvious? Now, regarding the details of his lecture, I leave them to our speaker, Elie Wiesel.
Actually, there's no need to continue now. So I will give another lecture on something else. In fact, luck, or mazel in Yiddish, is something we all need. Rich and poor, sick and healthy, young and not so young, some need it, all want it, all pray for it. And if they are lucky, their prayers are received. That's what we heard the fiddler of the roof say when, though hungry and forlorn, he felt like singing. In fact, it's in the Talmud, as is everything else. It says that Afilu Sefer Torah Shebeichal, even the holy scrolls in the sanctuary, need to be lucky to be chosen for public reading. And that surely applies to our prophets as well. Some are more fortunate than others, and on the other hand, some are more productive, others more popular than others. Jeremiah, Isaiah, Ezekiel are familiar names, and their words often quoted and used as examples in biblical courses or in public addresses. Perhaps we too are to be blamed. Haven't we studied them here in this hall, trying to explore the moral and poetic strength of their message and the exciting events of their lives? But why have we skipped Amos and Habakkuk, Micha and Malachi? Weren't they also great spokesmen for God to his people and from his people to our God? In spite of their power-packed lyrical and intense language, they are supposed to belong to the category of minor prophets, or more kindly, the 12 later prophets. Why such unfairness? How are we to explain such injustice? Is it only because their scarcity and brevity, some a few pages only? Since when does the number of pages have more weight than their content? So tonight we shall discuss two of these prophets, as you heard, Amos and Habakkuk. They have much in common. Both, of course, denounced debauchery and idolatry, but they also denounced and opposed social injustice with extraordinary conviction and vigor. Furthermore, both are known only through their words, more precisely. They appear on the stage of history almost relatively unknown, almost as anonymous characters deprived of unofficial biographies. We know a lot about Jeremiah, son of Hilkiyahu, the only prophet who had foreseen the catastrophe, foretold the catastrophe, and lived through the catastrophe, and survived to tell the tale. We know many things about Isaiah, son of Amoz, described as prince of the prophets, the fierce opponent to and victim of King Menashe's national policy of wickedness. We even know that it was the king himself who judged, sentenced, condemned, and killed the prophet. We know so much of Ezekiel's visions of the divine chariot and also of the dry bones in the desert. We even possess biographical material about one of the so-called 12 prophets, Hosea, and his marital problems. Talmudic sources are full of striking comments on and explanations of certain strange episodes related to his public or private personage. In fact, we know a lot about others, but what do we know about Amos and Habakkuk? Their files are embarrassingly scarce and poor. That the names of their mothers are not indicated must not shock us. Those of the so-called great prophets are also omitted. But here, even the names of their fathers are missing. Still, their words are available in every good and decent bookstore, and even in some hotel rooms, which provide spiritual nourishment to guests who are fed up with television. The moment we start reading any page of their books, we are faced with one certainty. They are prophets. They speak. They demand. They threaten. They don't try to please. Quite the contrary. They do whatever they can to displease, especially those who think that they have power, fortunes, happiness, everything that a person can get. They do not want to appease anyone. They wish to disturb people. They are free, and their only allegiance is to God. To grasp the very specificity of the prophet's function, let's imagine him as our contemporary, a young militant social activist, disgusted with what he or she sees in their country, decide on their own to speak up. It's as simple as that. The prophet can take it no more. Everywhere on every level, he feels offended. There is too much corruption in the land. Hunger for money, thirst for honors, obsession with power. The wealthy are indifferent to the plight of the poor. The learned despise each other. The men in charge of moral precepts and spiritual values create their own decadence. So the preacher leaves his home and goes to Washington, Las Vegas, or New York, places where the political or economic leadership is duty-bound to conduct government affairs. That is what the prophet did in those times. The prophet suddenly, or not so suddenly, gradually maybe becoming involved with God's voice, simply began to speak because he, or later she, had a vision. And there, what do they do, these prophets? What we call they spoke truth to power. Something which I like because I used that once when I spoke to President Reagan. And it became, I must say, very successful. Now there are books called Speaking Truth to Power, which is perfect. We must have that necessity to say to oneself, we must transcend our limitations. And if things are wrong, let's say it. Maybe you call it election, and we are in a period of elections. But in general, when the prophet speaks, who listens, who hears? Those who should listen don't. And that is why God, the God of Israel, God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, when he chose his prophets, he knew that the prophets would not be heard. And that was, of course, the tragedy of every prophet. When they went to Judea or Israel to chastise their people and ours, and our leaders then, to chastise them with their fiery message denouncing intellectual comfort and pleasurable sin, both causing unavoidable and implacable reactions, Nobody stopped them, not even heckled them. Nobody asked them to show proper credentials. No politician accused them of using God's name in vain for their own self-glorification. And when people did that, the prophets didn't care. They went on speaking. For the sake of truth, we must say that the image I just projected of prophets who were all-knowing and untouchable is somewhat exaggerated. They had no real immunity. They enjoyed no tangible privileges. As for popularity, theirs was hidden at best. Their very security was in jeopardy. Jeremiah was jailed. Isaiah maligned. Ruling circles and simple citizens occasionally distanced themselves from prophets. The prophets were living tragedies. But then, wasn't their master's destiny equally depressing? Did Moses have a happier life? Always torn between God and his people, he was compelled to refute all kinds of outrageous rumors and suspicions about him, including theft and philandering. Moses was accused of philandering. And the Midrash has certain images that I don't want to repeat, but it's in the text. And when we read and reread Moses' story, at times I wonder whether God's decision to prevent him from entering the promised land was not more of a reward than punishment. Perhaps God felt compassion for his loyal servant. Why send him to a new state where Jews will come to him with new complaints and all demands? He deserves some rest after all, doesn't he? And maybe that's why, says the Midrash, no one knew his place of burial, just to let him sleep quietly. I repeat, that was really in the Midrash, saying God said, if people will know where you are in your grave, they will bother you again and again. This is God, this is not good, this trouble, come and help. You deserve some peace. Oh yes, at least in this respect, all the prophets of Israel followed in Moses' footsteps, messengers of God. They often became victims of their people. No wonder that all were reluctant to accept the mission, but ended up to submitting to God's will. At this point, allow me to open our customary parentheses and offer a few personal remarks. For these parentheses, I must say that I always believed in gratitude. I believe that gratitude is a virtue that defines a person. Already as a child, I knew that upon opening my eyes in the morning, I must recite the prayer Modé Ani, which is a way of giving thanks simply for being alive and awake. After the war, paradoxically, inexplicably, I kept saying thank you to anyone I met, even strangers in the streets. I thanked them for remaining human. And now, as we begin our annual encounters this year, I wish to say how grateful I am to this magnificent institution for higher learning, for allowing me still to teach superb students whose eagerness to receive knowledge and share it with one another with an extraordinary feeling of respect for each other, that which remains for me a source of joy and hope. Their teachers are my superbly inspired colleagues in philosophy, religious studies, and uni, and of course those especially who, under the leadership of Professor Steve Katz, are in the Institute for Jewish Learning. They all bring pride to our common vocation, which I believe still to be the noblest of all. We have professors who come from Israel, professors who come from other places and from other universities and find a home here, and they find appreciation and friendship. The man who introduced me tonight brought me here from CCNY, New York City's prestigious city college. It took him almost 2 years to convince me to leave my New York base, and I never regretted it. We became friends the very first moment. In all these years, there was never a trace of disharmony in our relationship. The only problem I had with him was when he introduced me every year, because I came to learn that he knew more about some subjects than I. And I wished then always that he should speak after me at the end of my lecture, not in the beginning, so that he would be embarrassed, not I. But I was always impressed with his vast scholarship, his emphasis on integrity, his constant insistence on intellectual excellence and responsibility, his obsessive determination to raise this school to ever higher standards and triumphs. I fervently wish his successors all the varieties of success, which of course they deserve. But as he became the teacher he always was, a uniquely brilliant exponent of Kant's vision of humanity, a teacher who will, I'm sure, be a blessing to all those who will take his courses, I feel it's only proper for me to say that I will always remember what he has done for all of us with amazement and thankfulness. As for his introduction, on the other hand, every year I was nervously waiting for these opening lectures, wondering what new things he would say about my topic and my work, and he never failed to surprise me. This series began some 28, 29 years ago, and many events occurred since my first appearance on this stage. Our goal remains the same, to study together and share our passion for learning, our quest for meaning, by bringing past questions into a present filled with uncertainty. Usually, we explore the hidden light in ancient sources. How did Milton put it? There are no songs comparable to the songs of Zion, no orations equal to those of the prophets, and no politics like those which Scripture teaches us. Now, in this period of election, I wonder, what did he mean by the last part of his sentence? What politics can one learn from the Bible? We are told later on that hafochba ve'hafochba de kulaba, existing, everything is in the text. The history of one idea, one precept, one law, one story, one word can link us to the origins of memory. And that is why we have forever emphasized the eternal importance of receiving as faithfully and eagerly as possible what masters and disciples have left centuries and centuries ago as guidelines, so we may understand what often seems confused, dark, and bewildering in God's creation. Naturally, we know, and we must know, of course, what we learn. We learn what prophets meant to our society. We learn that without them, many things would have been different. Talmud says that Ilmalich Hatu Yisrael, had the people of Israel not sinned, we would have had no books of the prophets. We would have kept only the five books of Moses and the book of Isaiah, because the book of Isaiah contained the contract for the land of Israel. And otherwise, no. So says I always quote my great master and teacher and friend, Shaul Lieberman, Zichronor Livracha. He so says, what does it mean? It means that we should say thank you for sinning, because thanks to your sins we have literature. Well, literature, of course, maybe is part of this, but more than that, it's a treasure which remains open to anyone ready to take at least 1 hour, one day, and one life to remember. Prophets were not successful. Talmud says in but one place that the decree, the evil decree signed by Ahasuerus in the time of Esther, helped more Jews to remain Jewish than all the speeches, all the sermons, all the lessons delivered by all the prophets, both men and women. And what do we know? Was it difficult to become a prophet? Apparently not. When I think of the desire of some people to become prophets, I cannot, of course, but think of Eldad and Medad. Eldad and Medad, who were they? We know, they were two dreamers who make us dream. They are part of the 70 elders, we are told, but they alone are referred to by name. The others remain anonymous. And all are called upon to help Moses in his sacred duties. The fact is that Moses has enough of them. The people in his charge push him to despair. Notwithstanding the miracle of their liberation and that of the crossing of the Red Sea, they don't stop bickering and complaining. Notwithstanding the manna that falls from heaven to alleviate their hunger, they yearn for the good old days they have lived in Egypt. Yet, the heavenly manna is a gift unequaled in memory. It costs nothing and satisfies all tastes. And the Jews are ungrateful. Naturally, God is angry. As his emissary, he, Moses, wishes to resign. I can't take it anymore, he says to the Lord. Too heavy the task. And he says, if you really care about me, he says to God, make me die. It is then that God instructs him to gather around him a group of elders. They will be there when he speaks to him, and the divine spirit will rest upon them, and no longer will Moses be alone to bear the heavy burden of command. Moses complies with the divine will and assembles 70 old men and overseers, whom he names to high positions as judges, advisors, executives. What distinguishes them from the rest of the population is that they have authority. They are old. In those times, to be old was very good. They're old and they know how to get people to listen and to get things done. That's what Scripture says. But how and by what criteria have they been chosen by Moses? Does age alone merit such an honor? How does one determine the time which a man becomes old? Strange, I must quote, I think Gabriel Marquez, Le Havdil, says at one point, he says, about his age when he felt all of a sudden, he said, it's wrong to say that an old man cannot fall in love again. He simply says that a man who cannot fall in love again is old. That is perhaps true of our sages too. They had to be old to have authority, but they had authority that allowed them to speak as old prophets. Now the question, of course, was that all of a sudden, Joshua, the trusted servant of Moses, came running to Moses and said, Moses, can you imagine there are two young men, Eldad and Medad, and they want to be prophets? And Moses listened, didn't say anything. And then he went on, Joshua, look, he said, Moses, Lord, lock them up. There must have been a prison there. Lock them up. And there we find a marvelous dimension of Moses' greatness. The denunciation which reaches him doesn't face him. On the contrary, it seems to please him. What he says to Joshua, you wish to protect me and my position? And he said, Lou, I wish, he said, that the entire people were prophets. At that point, how can you not love Moses? I wish the entire people were prophets, he said. So Eldad and Medad maybe were or were not prophets. But prophets really only we had afterwards. Moses was the prince of the prophets, the Adon Hanavim, the greatest of them all. And then we had afterwards Joshua, and then we had the judges. Only later, when Israel became a monarchy, the prophecy became part of the institution. And so we have Amos and Habakkuk. Though different in many ways, what they have in common is an inordinate amount of frustration. Political activists, moral agitators, social critics, all they say is penetrated by a desire to change the world around them. What is possibly good in society, they don't see. And what they see, they abhor. As we said of Amos, we know a little, of Habakkuk even less than that. Their names figure nowhere else except in their books. Who is a prophet? How does one become a prophet? What does one do, or what does one have to do, or say, or own, or disown, or acquire, or study in order to become a prophet in the life and the annals of Israel and Judah? And once the prophet has acquired prophecy, what is his role? And how does one identify the prophet? A prophet dresses like everybody else by his behavior. A prophet behaves normally. The prophet eats, drinks, sleeps, walks like everybody else. It's only when he or she speaks that they become different. When the prophet speaks, is it the voice of God one hears? Whose unhappiness is reflected in his admonishment? His own, the prophet's own, or the Creator's? Is the prophet just a human vehicle, able and compelled to repeat the divine message word by word, without adding a phrase, a comment, a warning of his own? Abraham Joshua Heschel believed that a prophet is a person who sees the world with the eyes of God, a person who holds God and man in one thought at one time at all times, who suffers harms down to others. Living in dismay, he has the power to transcend dismay. And also, says Heschel, the prophet is a man who feels fiercely. God has thrust a burden upon his soul, and he's bowed and stunned at man's fierce greed. Prophecy is the voice that God has lent to the silent agony, a voice to the plundered poor, to the profaned rules of the world. God is raging in the prophet's words. No, wait a second. God? Not the person who is his emissary? Have we sufficiently spoken in past encounters of the prophet's sense of loneliness? Whom could he or she have talked to when not repeating God's powerful and awesome words? The people in the street, they expected and feared only his angry outbursts that dealt with their lives, not his. With his colleagues, perhaps, a question worth considering. Amos, Hosea, and Isaiah were contemporaries. Have they met? Have they been in the same room together, in the same courtyard? Have they attended meetings? Have they discussed matters of mutual concern, such as the best method, for instance, to inspire an audience or to avoid the king's wrath? If all prophets were spiritually, after all, linked, then we know that Amos and Habakkuk had of their link only a vague notion. Now, who are they? Amos may derive from Omas, or Mamasa, Omes, or Mamasa, which means burden. Does it indicate that prophecy was his burden and that it was predestined? He became the prophet because of his name? The little we know of Amos and his work comes from his own willingness to offer the few elements of his personal life. He was born in Tekoa, not far from Bethlehem, 10 miles south from Jerusalem, into a family of field workers. He was a shepherd, caring for his flock, a dresser of sycamore or fig trees. Some sources also mention him as a stutterer, which is strange. A prophet who lives with a word could be a stutterer like Moses. Some sources also say that in argument with a violent adversary, he claimed to say, to be neither prophet nor the son of a prophet. Has he made a living from his prophetic speeches? As Amatsya the priest, his fierce adversary, seems to insinuate. He had many enemies, Amos. Who knows? Was he married? Did he live with his parents? Has he joined a school of prophets? There were schools of prophets in times of prophet Elijah. All these questions and many more remain unanswered. All we know is that one day, well, let's open the text. Divrei Amos Asher Haya Banogdim Mitakoa. The words of Amos, who was among the herdmen of Tekoa, which he saw concerning Israel in the days of Uzziah, king of Judah, and in the days of Jeroboam, the son of Joash, king of Israel, Shenataim Lifnei Harash, 2 days before Harash. Harash means what? Does it mean the tempest? Does it refer to an earthquake, maybe to a psycho-religious earthquake connected with the terrible blows that God will inflict upon Judah and Israel for their transgressions, as he, the prophet, had foreseen them? Are these 2 words here just to indicate the time when the shepherd became a public figure and emerged as God's spokesman? From this first verse, which includes 2 royal names, we learn how to place the event. He must have started his prophetic career around 752 before the Common Era. His mission, like Habakkuk's, it was to wake up the inhabitants of both kingdoms of Judah and Israel, which enveloped the 10 tribes. They needed to be awakened. That much is clear. For in both lands, the material situation couldn't be better. Both kingdoms have regained all the territory promised by God to Abraham and his descendants and ruled by David and Solomon. It seems quite possible that the rulers of the two kingdoms have concluded an alliance, creating a powerful united front against all enemies. Both are mentioned in the Chronicles as concerned with military matters, building fortresses and modernizing weaponry. Various sources indicate that under Jeroboam II, the kingdom of Israel restored its historical borders from Heimat to the ocean and reached into Damascus. As for the kingdom of Judah under King Uzziah, its army defeated the Philistines, the Arabs, the Ammonites. Judean workers constructed Eilat and attracted on the way several wandering tribes that placed themselves under Jewish protection. On the surface, everything seemed fine. But upon reading and rereading the prophetic observations and admonitions of Amos and his peers, who acted as God's reporters, one cannot but reach the conclusion that material welfare, economic stability, and national glory are often obtained at the expense of spiritual aspirations. In the prophet's lyrical and pathetic condemnation of the offensive luxury of the rich and the excesses of the mighty, one can see, as in a mirror, concrete and tangible images of how the ruling class lives. They possess huge vineyards, summer homes, and winter palaces, precious ivory and expensive oil, and women who love drinking wine a bit too much. What about those who belong to the lower classes of the population, neglected and forsaken? The poor are poorer, lonelier, unhappier. Some are exploited and oppressed, others sold into slavery. Of course, they ought to turn to the courts asking for protection, or at least for intervention. But what can they do in a state where the judges, corrupt in every way, ought to be judged for favoring the sinners, the exploiters, the arrogant men who believed they owned the whole world? All prophets are obsessed with social justice. All prophets denounce human deprivation producing iniquity. But Amos and Habakkuk more so. They are endowed with prophetic powers because of their sensitivity to other people's pains and fears. To be more precise, it is not because they are prophets that they are so sensitive. They are prophets because they are so sensitive. And because they are concerned with language, they find the words, or the words find them, to side with the victims of society or the prisoners of destiny and listen to Amos. Woe to those who are at peace with themselves in Zion, and to those who think they are safe on the mountain of Samaria. The notables among nations who come to the house of Israel pass to Calneh, and from there to Heimat the Great, and from there to Philistine Gath. Be they better than these kingdoms? Is their territory greater than your territory? You who bring near the seat of violence, woe to those who lie on beds of ivory and stretch themselves out and eat lambs from the flock and calves from the midst of the stall, who sing idle songs to the sound of the harp, who drink wine in bowls, anoint themselves with the most precious of oils, but are not distressed over the affliction of the house of Joseph. Therefore, says Amos, they will be the first to be exiled. But before criticizing their fellow Jews, the prophet blames other nations too. Speaking of the city-states, Damascus, Gaza, Tyrus, Edom, Ammon, and Moab, Amos uses the same warning. And he says, for three of their transgressions I will restrain my punishment, but for the fourth I will not. What was the fourth for which there was no forgiveness? Thrashing Gilead with instruments of iron in the case of Damascus, handing over peaceful captives to Edom in the case of Gaza and Tyrus, for pursuing brothers with a sword, as was the case of Edom, for raping women with child, as was the case of the Edomites, for burning the bones of the Edomite king, as was the case of the Moabites. Think about it. All these sins deal with transgressions committed by heathens against heathens, pagans against each other. Jews are hardly mentioned here. the consequences, exile and destruction, suffering and humiliation. To the prophet, the God of Israel is also the God of the world. The laws of justice equally apply to all his children. And when they violate them, God is angry, even when the targeted victim is a Gentile, a non-Jew, a pagan. But having enumerated the various sins and their different retributions of neighboring nations, Amos turns to Judah and Israel. And there again God says, for 3 transgressions of Judah I will turn away the punishment thereof, but for the 4th I will not turn away the punishment thereof, because they have despised the law of the Lord and have not kept his commandments, and their lies cause them distance. I will send a fire upon Judah, and it shall devour the palaces of Jerusalem. Themselves will be punished from the paths of their fathers. That's for the kingdom of Judah. Then it's the turn of the other state, Israel. Thus said the Lord, for 3 transgressions of Israel I shall turn away the punishment thereof, but for the 4th I will not turn away the punishment thereof, because they sold the righteous for silver and the poor for a pair of shoes. And he evoked both recent and distant memories to strengthen his prosecutory argument. I brought you out of the land of Egypt and led you 40 years in the wilderness to possess the land of the Amorite. And I raised up some of you sons for prophets and some of young men for Nazirites. Isn't it so, O people of Israel? But you made the Nazirite drink wine and ordered the prophets, saying, you shall not prophesy. Now later one can almost hear the prophet's voice getting louder, stronger, angrier. Only you have I known of all the families of the earth. Therefore I shall punish you for all your iniquities. In other words, it is because Judah and Israel are different, because their mission to the world is special, that God's disappointment over their shortcomings is so deeply felt. From them he expected something else, something more. If not absolute loyalty, then at least a measure of gratitude. Isn't this the leitmotif in most, if not all, prophetic texts? The great French theologian Pascal called Jewish history the story of God's love affair with Israel. As any other love affair, it includes quarrels and reconciliations, moments of despair and hours of ecstasy. And who is the chronicler of that story? The prophet. Having met Amos, let's turn to his companion tonight, Habakkuk. From the outset, I must confess my bias. I like him. It's because his book is shorter, perhaps, only 3 chapters. His language more condensed, and above all, his life more secretive. And there is another reason as well, which I'll return to it later. First, let's listen to his words. Woe to him who heaps up what is not his own. Woe to him who gets evil gain for his house. For the stone cries out from the wall, and the beam from the woodwork responds. Woe to him who builds a town with blood and found a city on iniquity. The personal tragedy of the prophet, always. Always angry and anguished, even disgusted, disillusioned. He sees only what is unworthy in human nature, what is cruel in society, what is distressing in history. Rooted in the present, his vision evokes the future, both near and far. He doesn't use imagination except as a tool to push reality to its logical and sometimes grotesque conclusions. Is it possible, even conceivable, that God speaks to all of us, but only the prophet listens to his words? Is that the prophet who knows how to listen, not how to speak? And does God speak to him because he listens? Is Amos fair always when he condemns an entire people and issues collective indictments of our people? Does he protest as Moses had done when God's anger was too harsh? Did he at least argue with the Almighty? Did he question his ways? Did he on occasion wonder whether punishment could be God's logic in human affairs? To Amos, everything is simple and logical. If the people sin, it will suffer. If it suffers, it is because it has sinned. And God may be asked to forgive, but not to answer questions. And as we shall see later, this is exactly what Amos has done. He did not let things stay. He did not argue with God, but he pleaded with God. in order for God not only to abolish and to annul the decree, actually he pleaded with God to make God, the creator of the world, the judge of all judges, the king of kings, he pleaded with God to repent. Habakkuk is a little bit different. We hastily looked away from Amos' companion, but who is Habakkuk? Well, he is a prophet of whose life really we know nothing. But we know that he did protest against divine justice, which entrusted the Babylonians the task of punishing the children of Israel. Did he consider the enemy as God's emissary, his whip to strike the sinners? If so, doesn't he give the enemy of Israel too much credit? Many decades ago in post-war Paris, Jean-Paul Sartre, the existentialist philosopher, gave his own definition of the Jew, making the Jew a product of anti-Semitism. In other words, I am not hated because of my Jewishness, but I am Jewish because I am hated. And the philosopher, just shortly before he died, honest enough, in a conversation with a young Jewish Maoist, turned Talmudic scholar, who passed away last year in Jerusalem. But this young man, who was his secretary, persuaded Jean-Paul Sartre to disown that weird and condescending theory, admitting that he knew a lot about philosophy, but nothing about Jewish culture, Jewish religion, Jewish faith, Jewish tradition. As mentioned earlier, the name Habakkuk is to be found nowhere else in biblical sources. Some commentators believe it derives from the word chibuk, which means embracing. Was Habakkuk embracing God or his people? Was he embraced by them? Other commentators maintain that the Hebrew name is linked to the Assyrian word chambakuku, which is the name of a plant. Is that all we know of him? Yes, that's all. And that's what I like about him. He has nothing but a voice that reverberates throughout generations. Did I say he has a voice? Why not say he is a voice? To hear it best, we close our eyes and let imagination, yours and mine, do the rest. We said earlier that both prophets have much in common. They both were God's messengers. But did they carry the same message? Was it delivered in the same manner? Wasn't Amos' anger characteristic, whereas Habakkuk's was sadness? Let's compare their beginnings. Let's repeat the introductory lines of the book of Amos, the words of Amos, who was among the herdmen of Tekoa, which is so concerning Israel in the days of Uzziah, king of Judah, and in the days of Jeroboam, son of Joash, king of Israel, 2 years before the earthquake. Essential facts such as the time and place of his prophecy and the names of the rulers are already indicated. Now let's listen to the opening of Habakkuk. It's shorter. Hamasa, Asher, Chaza, Habakkuk, Hanavi. This is the burden, the prophet Habakkuk's vision. Masa has many, many meanings. Now only 3 of the 12 prophets are immediately called prophets, not Amos. We don't say Amos Hanavi. Habakkuk, we say right away, Habakkuk is one of the 3. He is called immediately a prophet. And to understand him, we need to learn something of the century he lived in, the one that preceded the destruction of the first temple. History endures political and military convulsions, accompanied by extreme brutality and despair, affecting the lives of Assyrians, Chaldeans, Persians, Phoenicians, Babylonians, Egyptians, and Jews. In Judah, King Josiah goes to war against Egypt. He dies on the battlefield. He is succeeded by his son Joachas, but his reign lasts only 3 months and is exiled to Egypt. His brother Joachim succeeds him as king. He rebels against Egypt, surrenders to Babylon, only to rebel against his new general Nabuchodonosor, who sends him in chains in exile. He dies on the way to Babylonia. Nabuchodonosor appoints Zedekiah as Judah's new king, and after a period of turmoil, ends up as conqueror of Jerusalem. And his destruction of the temple and its sanctuary is remembered in sadness to this day. Habakkuk's prophecy, delivered one generation or 30-odd years before the destruction of Jerusalem, deals mainly with the evil done by the Chaldeans, their power and their downfall. His first outcry is not to his own people, but to God. O Lord, how long shall I cry, and thou wilt not hear? How long shall I alert you to the reign of violence, and you will not help? The prophet turns personal in depicting Chaldean victories. Why do you show me iniquity and pain? Why do you make me see wrongs and look upon trouble? Destruction and violence are before me, strife and contention everywhere. The law is perverted, justice twisted. And God answers and says, I am rousing the Chaldeans, that bitter and hasty nation who march through the breadth of the earth to seize habitations not their own. Their horses are swifter than leopards, more fierce than evening wolves. Terror precedes them. They gather captives like sand, guilty men whose own might is their God. Interestingly, in these three chapters, there isn't much open criticism of his own people. It is mainly directed at his enemies. Just as they oppress us, they in turn will be oppressed. But aren't they God's instrument of punishment? Yes, they are. Still, the choice is in their own hands. Having set the temple of Jerusalem on fire, says the Talmud, Nabuchodonosor felt like singing God's glory when the angel Michael appeared and slapped him in the face. But hasn't he done God's will when he inflicted suffering on Judah? Yes, but he had no business turning someone else's suffering into song. When a community endures pain and agony, forget poetry, just weep, especially when the pain and agony came from you. Habakkuk's love for his people is so profound and so all-encompassing that he dares taking God to task. He does predict the catastrophe as a consequence of sin and transgression that plagued the early period of King Josiah's reign. But he raises the question, are other nations better than yours? I remember in my hometown, I often heard an old woman speaking to the Almighty in the middle of the holiday services and saying, Oh God, atabechartanu, we say in our prayers, you have chosen us among other nations, please do us a favor. For 1 year, choose someone else. And Habakkuk describes the true nature of pagans, the riches of their food, the scandal of their luxury, their greed, their viciousness, their cruelty. He is the real prosecutor of the enemies. To him they are all filled with shame, and he asks for their punishment. Woe to him who builds a town with blood and erects a city of it by iniquity. And he says, the cup of the Lord's right hand will be turned unto thee, and shameful spewing shall be on thy glory. Though his prediction of catastrophe is not clear, its insinuation is the Chaldeans or Babylonians will strike Judah and make its existence filled with distress and affliction, but they will not emerge from the conflict unscathed. Both Amos and Habakkuk and most prophets, major and minor alike, are moved at the end by infinite compassion. Compassion for their people. At the end of struggle, there will be peace. At the end of time, there will be redemption, for in final analysis, God's grace must fill the universe. And both Jews and Gentiles will benefit from his desire to show love towards his entire creation. Even the wicked, them too. All adults have been children, and all children are God's children. Listen to Habakkuk. Though the fig tree does not blossom, nor fruit appear on the vine, and no produce of the olive around, and no food in the field, I will rejoice in the Lord, the joy of my salvation. Listen to Amos. I will restore the fortunes of my people Israel, and they shall rebuild the ruined cities and inhabit them. They shall plant vineyards and drink their wine. They shall make gardens and eat their fruit. I will plant them upon their land, and they shall never again be plucked up or out of the land which I gave them, says the Lord your God. And so in conclusion, actually I said I like Habakkuk. Now I like both of them. I like because of their profound humanity. It resonates in all friends of human beings. I like them because of the mystery surrounding their life and work. In a way, they appeal to the novelist in me. Having turned the last page of the book bearing his name, we don't know more about any one of them than we knew before reading the first verse. Is it because of Habakkuk's courage to question the creator of worlds and his obscure ways in governing human destiny? Hasn't Abraham wondered aloud whether God would really administer equal punishment to the just and the unjust? Hasn't Jeremiah done the same when addressing God, saying more or less, Oh yes, O Lord, you are righteous, but I shall argue with you and quarrel with you. Why do the wicked enjoy good fortune, whereas the good are subjected to suffering? Has Jeremiah received an answer, yes or no? He is offering it to us, his readers and students and disciples and heirs. In chapter 2, he says, Here is a vision and write it down on the tablets. It's too early to prejudge the denouement. It will come. And even though it will be late, wait for it. For the tzaddik, the just person, will live in its faith. And the earth will be covered with the knowledge of God's glory. And it will cover it just as waters cover the sea. naturally. Oh, we often wonder. We often wonder, will all that occur? But one thing we should know about Amos, which I hinted at earlier. I found it in an essay published in the Biblical Review by a certain Daniel Noel Friedman. He says that Amos' personality is so great because who, like Moses, was the only one who didn't content himself to obey God or even question his ways. He really went much further. At least on two occasions he managed to make God repent rather than implement all the suffering he had said he would bring upon the Jewish people. At the beginning of chapter 7 we read, "And the Lord said, the high places of Isaac shall be made desolate, and the sanctuaries of Israel shall be laid waste, and I will rise against the house of Jeroboam with a sword." But Amos immediately interceded on behalf of his people, and lo and behold, the Lord repented. "It shall not be," said the Lord. Then God again uttered words of doom. Again Amos intervened, and God repented. In other words, we owe these two minor prophets, so to speak, we owe much to them. And we even know why. We know why they spoke, and we know what they have done, and we hear their words. And although we know so little about them, you read their words, and I say to you, let's imagine them alive.
You just heard the first of three lectures in the annual series, The Fascination with Jewish Tales, by teacher, author, and Nobel Peace Prize winner Elie Wiesel. Next week, we'll have the second lecture in this annual series entitled America, Memories of Doubts and Hope. For a CD or a cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. CDs and cassettes are $15, which includes shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by Matt Odette and Michael Garth, with help from Ian Hughes. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. I'm Dolores Handy. Thanks for joining us.